Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, my guest will be Dr. Sonia Santelises, the CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools. The academic year has been underway now for, I guess, a little less than 2 months, and we'll get a progress report on how things are going so far here in the city, and we'll look ahead as teachers and students learn to cope with the new normal of being in classrooms together in a pandemic that has yet to subside. Jury selection began yesterday in the trial of three white men accused of chasing and killing Ahmaud Arbery, a 25-year-old black man from Brunswick, Georgia. Video from the incident in February of last year shows two of the men confronting and shooting Mr. Arbery when he was jogging. The men are charged by Georgia authorities with malice and felony murder. They've also been indicted with federal hate crime and attempted kidnapping charges. For years, the number of hate crimes in the U.S. has steadily increased. So now we're going to explore what effect the addition of hate crime charges to other charges has in legal proceedings. If one is convicted of a violent crime like murder, what is gained by an additional conviction that is premised in that killer's frame of mind and prejudice? Joining me now is Dr. Frank Pizzella. He's an associate professor in the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. He studies hate crimes, and he's written two monographs on the subject, including one called Hate Crime Statutes, A Public Policy and Law Enforcement Dilemma. His latest book is called The Measurement of Hate Crimes in America. Dr. Pizzella joins us on Zoom from White Plains, New York. Dr. Pizzella, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Tom. Thank you for having me.
So I wonder if you could give us an overview, because you have written about both the upside, the advantages, and the downside, the disadvantages of hate crime statutes. Give us the arguments in both camps, if you will.
All right. So the upside is hate crimes are unlike ordinary crimes. Hate crimes, you know, what I often tell my students is that they offenders attack people not for who they are, but for what they are. And in that sense, it incurs a significant amount of physical, psychological, and emotional injuries on victims. But not only that, as well as the member groups that they belong to, and creates this kind of intergroup distrust. Unlike ordinary crimes, that tends to be somewhat personal. You know, so that's the upside, and that's why we find, you know, that in now 47 states, now including Georgia, since the Ahmaud Arbery incident, you know, has hate crime statutes. So now all of these states now have these hate crime statutes because they recognize that this is a kind of unique kind of injury. The downside is that they're very difficult to prove. You know, what we're talking about is establishing an elevated mens rea, an elevated thought crime, you know, almost. How can you get into the head of a hate crime offender? How does a prosecutor prove that it was motivated by hate or bias? And in your ordinary hate crimes, not the kind that happened with Dylan Ruth or Ahmaud Arbery or other people like that, ordinary hate crimes it's not very clear at all. You know, it's the what we call the mission offender doesn't establish what his bias motivation is. And so it puts the onus on a prosecutor to determine whether he should bring a hate crime charge or he should see if he can get the offender to take a plea to an ordinary charge. And with respect to police have a couple of seconds maybe to establish if there was a bias motivation. And as I said, it's not always very, very clear. So unless they have sufficient training, you know, that won't always be the case. So that's why we have this, you know, this problem of police classification of hate crimes, as well as victim underreporting of hate crimes. And that's a another story that perhaps we'll get into a little bit later in this interview.
Yeah, because if a prosecutor faces a jury and says, all right, I'm going to prove that this defendant murdered someone, and the prosecutor would likely propose a motive for the murder, right? But in a hate crime, the prosecutor has to prove the motive for the murder, not just say, here's a likely reason that this person committed this crime, and here's the evidence that says the crime definitely was committed by this person. So when that extra layer is added on, does it diminish in any way the original case or the original argument about the act itself, the crime that occurred? I mean, does it put prosecutors at a disadvantage if they have to argue both cases, both the case for the murder itself and the motivation for the murder?
Well, the motivation is a problem because of the issue of double jeopardy. If a prosecutor decides to bring the case as a hate crime, then and they lose, they cannot come back and bring the case again, you know, as a murder trial. So they are really kind of taking a chance. And unless they have sufficient proof to establish that kind of biased motivation, they often won't bring the case as a hate crime at all. And so that's why you often see many of these crimes are pled out. So if you look at the course, lots of cases that start out, you know, as a hate crime end up being pled out to an ordinary crime. And then, you know, keep in mind that prosecutors want convictions. And if there's a chance that they're not going to get that conviction, you know, then it behooves them just not to bring the case as a hate crime at all.
Dr. Frank Brazella is an associate professor of criminal justice at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. We're talking about hate crime statutes. Hate crimes are prosecuted throughout the country. We've had a big increase in the number of hate crimes that have been reported over the last several years. What do you think about hate crime statutes? Should we have them? Should prosecutors be inclined to bring hate crime charges in addition to the crimes themselves, the charges associated with those crimes? Let us know. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWIPR. And you mentioned, Dr. Pizzella, that police have a very short window, a matter of seconds, in which to make a determination about the motivation for these crimes. You also say that some 89% of law enforcement agencies do not report any hate crimes each year. Even though we've had an increase in the number of hate crimes overall, we have nearly 90% not reporting any year after year. How do you reconcile those two seemingly contrary facts?
You know, you're quoting me correctly, that's for sure. So let's consider this. And this gets to the issue of underreporting. We have approximately 18,500 police agencies in the United States. Only maybe 75% participate in the hate crime reporting program. So we already start out with the statistical disability, you know, with that other 25%. But of the remaining 75% that do participate, 88 to 90% over the last 10, 15, 20 years report zero hate crimes every year. You know, so either we have no hate crimes in these jurisdictions or we have a problem, a systemic reporting problem. Give you an example. Do you remember the Pulse nightclub shooting several years ago?
Yeah, in Orlando, Florida, you know, yeah.
Yes, in which, how many victims were there? About 53? 53?
I think so,
well,
yeah.
Guess what? The police reported three hate crimes that year. Now, in some ways, it's an unfair comparison because the police are reporting incidents. They're not necessarily reporting victims. But still, you know, when you think about the extent and the prevalence of hate crimes, you're not thinking about incidents. When you think of an incident that has 53 victims, that seems to be, you know, almost a misinterpretation of the severity of this kind of offense.
Dr. Frank Pizzella is an associate professor of criminal justice at the John Jay College up in New York. We'll continue our conversation with Dr. Pizzella after a quick break. We'll talk about hate crimes and we'll take your calls, questions, and comments. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. To follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR. Stay with us.
You're listening to 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking about hate crimes statutes. There has been a marked increase in the number of hate crime cases over the last few years, despite the fact, as we were just saying before the break, that 89% of participating law enforcement agencies report no hate crimes at all every year. So no one disagrees that hate crime behavior needs to be stopped, but there is much less consensus as to how that should be accomplished. My guest is Dr. Frank Pizzella. He's a scholar of hate crimes. He teaches at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. He's on Zoom. You are welcome to join us as well. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org, and you can tweet us @MiddayWYPR. And Dr. Pizzella, if you can indulge us, let's go to the phones. We have a listener named Kenvi who's on the line from Baltimore. Welcome to the show. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I want to comment about how at least the LGBT community in the 90s originally saw a hate crimes bill. We never really thought of punishment. We thought of it as early police reform and as a deterrent to behavior. How it was experienced if you lived in the neighborhood was that someone would be assaulted. The police might come out and take a report. If by some miracle someone was caught, they would get some, and they went to the system, they'd get some slap on the wrist. A month or so later, they'd be back in the neighborhood doing the exact same thing. So the concept of the 16 will get you 20 as a deterrent, as word got out, that, you know, certain kinds of behaviors be proven in court, had more of a penalty. People would rethink those behaviors.
All right. Well, thanks for that comment. And Dr. Pizzella, has it proven? Is there other data that suggests that it is a deterrent if folks know that their bias, if it is proven, is going to increase their sentence?
Well, our research doesn't indicate that it has actually acted as a deterrent. What primarily acts as a deterrent is when society has an outrage against these kinds of offenses. The LGBT community, you know, is one of the major groups that have been identified as a vulnerable group by the FBI and by I think 18 or 19 states in their state hate crime legislation. In addition, you know, my collaborator, co-author and I, Dr. Matthew Shepard from Shippensburg University, and I found that that, for instance, lesbians were more likely to suffer from severe victimization, you know, than any other type of bias victim group, you know. So there is something, and let me just say that there's also some other research that says that hate crimes, you know, against the LGBT community is tends to be somewhat much more severe than hate crimes against others. So, you know, you kind of wonder, what is it about, you know, offenders' feelings against the LGBT community that makes them act so viciously, so violently against this particular vulnerable group?
And of course, as you've written, I mean, one of the big arguments for hate crime statutes is that when a victim is attacked, it is an attack on that entire community. It spreads fear. It's one of the most pernicious aspects of a hate crime. If people know that just because of your sexual orientation or your religion or your race, that you are going to be more susceptible or more of a target for a violent biased person, it spreads fear throughout the entire community. It that crime radiates way past just the individual victim, doesn't it?
Well, exactly. It gets at what I said earlier. Hate crime offenders attack victims not for who they are, but for what they are. And in fact, you know, there's several victims. There's a primary victim and there's secondary victims. When you attack a victim because he's gay, you know, you're attacking the entire gay community. You're sending a message to the entire gay community that you better watch out, that you could be next. You know, if you put a swastika, you know, on a synagogue or a burning cross, you know, on an African-American person's lawn, you're sending a signal, you know, to everybody in that community. You know, I can't, you know, I want to remind you of what that burning cross means, you know, to the African-American community as far as dating back to the times of lynching, as well as the swastika with respect to the Holocaust. So, you know, these kind of symbols and these kinds of acts really kind of send a message, you know, to these victim groups, not necessarily to the individual, but to the entire group, that you could be next.
And in one of your briefs on this subject, you talk about the statutes as being a public policy and law enforcement dilemma. And one of the arguments that you explain is that there are enhanced penalties for certain specialty especially protected groups, but not for others. So how do you, and given the uneven enforcement that we've already talked a little bit about, if you've got some groups that hate crimes are applied to, you know, with regularity, and others where it's not, is there a difference? Is there a tension between various groups and people figuring out which groups should be protected and which should not? Who's making that call?
Well, you know, your state legislators are making that call. You know, the federal government is making that call. You know, we know that hate crimes, broadly speaking, is a criminal offense against a person because of their membership in a group. But then states go on to define who those groups are. Only maybe 18 states statutorily protect the LGBT community. You know, not many, you know, protect necessarily disability victims. You know, so it does vary. You know, and how that decision is made is, you know, is again, you know, up to, you know, state legislators. You know, so it's... you know, again, it comes down to the politics of the particular jurisdiction.
If you've just joined us, it's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest is Dr. Frank Pezzella. He's a scholar of hate crimes, and he teaches at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. We're talking about hate crime statutes and the upside and the downside of these statutes for the communities as well as for prosecutors. 410-662-8780, our email midday at wypr.org, our Twitter handle at midday. WIPR. Let's go to the phones again. Todd is on the line in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday with Dr. Pezzella.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Doctor. I was wondering if Doctor could comment a little bit more about the unintended consequences of hate crimes, particularly in a system that already disproportionately affects minority communities, many of whom the hate crime legislation is intended to protect. So in effect, when we're enforcing them, we're going to be clamping down on minority communities. I mean, you look at tensions between a lot of Black communities and Asian communities, examples like that where you're trying to protect one class, in the end you're still punishing. And then it's certainly interesting to me as a public defender to see and hear your guests say that there's no proven empirical evidence of deterrence, just like with mandatory sentencing. So what are we doing here? Why not just educate the community further?
Well, I certainly believe you know, we should educate the community about the deleterious effects of hate crimes. But as to the unintended consequences, one of those main unintended consequences you already mentioned, and that is the groups that are designed for hate crime statutes to protect are often arrested as offenders. African-Americans, you know, in particular, You know, the there's a tendency for, you know, for other groups to, you know, to look at groups that are protected and to have some sort of a reaction or negative reaction about why they're protected and others are not. You know, so there's definitely a problem and some unintended consequences of these kinds of, you know, these kind of statutes. That's for sure.
And Dr. Pizzella, you've written about how the criteria for proving a hate crime are developed. The FBI has 14 different indicators. And do I understand it correctly that all 14 must be present for a criminal offense to be called a bias crime? And if so, can you give us an example of the kind of criteria and the examples of where it's very difficult to prove all 14 of those indicators?
Well, no. So not all 14 indicators need to be proven. Certainly not. You know, but the FBI talks about several of the indicators. For instance, the offender and victims were of a different race, religion, disability, sexual orientation, ethnicity, gender, and gender identity. There was bias-related oral comments, bias-related drawings, certain objects. A victim was visiting a neighborhood where previous hate crimes had been committed. So, you know, again, there's 14 of them. But according to the FBI, these are just merely indicators. And this is what the FBI offers to police departments, particularly for line police officers, to identify the possibility, you know, of a bias crime. In most jurisdictions, in most police departments, I know in NYPD, they have a hate crime unit. The police officer, the line police officer, identifies what he may think is a possible hate crime based on those 14 indicators. And again, it's not all 14, it's any number happening at the same time. The offense happened on Hitler's birthday or on a Jewish holiday, and it's an anti-Semitic hate crime, and, you know, and things like that. And so generally what the line officer is required to do is to make the arrest and indicate, you know, that it's a possible hate crime. And they then, the police jurisdiction would then send out a bias crime unit, you know, to look further into it to see if it can, you know, if they want to bring the charge, you know, actually as a hate crime.
You are an advocate, if I understand it correctly, for making hate crime reporting mandatory for law enforcement agencies. How would that work?
First of all, we have to understand that hate crimes are probably, most likely, one of the most underreported offenses that we have. Give you an example. What we've been talking about is the hate crime stats from the Uniform Hate Crime Reporting System. Now we know, you know, that that hate crimes are underreported because they are only the ones that are identified by police. So Rota did some research on this notion of a dark figure of hate crime underreporting. And what we looked at was victimizations. And so when you look at the Bureau of Justice statistics and they identify that there has been a total, and this is victim reporting, 250,000 hate crimes a year, you know, for the last 10 years. And you compare that to the Uniform Crime Report, they're averaging about 7,000 or 8,000. It just doesn't reconcile, you know. So there is substantial, you know, underreporting. And many of those victims claim, at least 100,000 of those victims claim, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, that they did report, but somehow it didn't get through to the police reporting system.
I just have about a minute left. What about the argument? I've heard some lawyers make this argument, prosecutors make this argument to me, who say it's just not necessary. If you're going to try somebody for murder and he's convicted of the murder, he's going to go to jail for a long, long time. And the hate crime is kind of piling on. We don't need any additional sentence. If you've got a life sentence or, you know, 80 years or something, you just simply don't need the hate crime as a legal remedy to this person having committed a crime. He's already being charged and indicted and convicted of a bad crime, and his motivation just doesn't really matter to the state. How do you respond to that?
Well, that is a typical prosecutor argument. It's easier to bring the ordinary homicide charge. That's the idea that a murder is a murder is a murder. But when you charge and convict somebody of a hate crime, you're also sending a message to the community that this type of offense will not be tolerated.
Well, Dr. Pezzella, I really appreciate your time. This has really been a great conversation, and we will certainly keep tabs on what's going on in Brunswick, Georgia, in the Ahmaud Arbery case, and consider many of the great points you've made this afternoon. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Frank Pezzella, he's an associate professor of criminal justice at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, I'll have a conversation with Dr. Sonia Sonalisis. She's, of course, the CEO of the Baltimore City Public School System. And coming up next, it's Here and Now. That's after the news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for being with us today here on Midday. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.